for the people who had been fighting for 7 years alongside them in solidarity with them, and fighting for the rights to clean water, clean air, which the fossil fuel industry has destroyed, basically. So we're destroying our planet, we're destroying our way of life, we're destroying the water up here in Minnesota, where the headwaters of the Mississippi River are, where it's the land of 1,000 lakes, and we're destroying those lakes. And we went under 200 bodies of water, and we were up there to say no, basically, no to destroying the land, destroying the water, destroying the air, destroying the way of life of everybody.
Milan, I'm wondering how you feel the trial is going and why you refuse to take a plea deal on the felony charge. You're facing also a $10,000 fine.
Right. I could not sign the papers saying that I was guilty because I am not the guilty party here. Enbridge is destroying, is violent. The just destroying the land to put a pipeline that we know is going to leak is violence against the earth, the water, the people who live on this land and depend on that. So, I could not take the plea deal. I'm not guilty. And if the state wants to prove me guilty, then they have to do that, which so far has not happened. And yet, I'm still here fighting. I'm still in court. I'm going to testify today. And even Sheriff Gaida, who extracted us in the most careless manner, has not been able to prove or has not said that I was doing anything wrong up there. I'm a nonviolent activist. I believe in nonviolence. Everything I do, that's my daily life, is nonviolence. So I was up there. I was not obstructing legal process, which is the charge I got. I was just up there protesting an abomination. And so I would say the trial is a farce right now at this point. My lawyer is at our hands with reminding the court and the prosecution about procedures, about the law, about legalese 101 that everybody should respect in court. And it's not happening. It's not happening. And there's so many reasons that my case should have been dismissed by now. And I'm going to testify today.
Well, you're very brave to come on. And, you know, we're talking after Lahaina was destroyed as a result of climate change in Hawaii, after the south of the United States, particularly Florida and the Carolinas, have been hit hard by Hurricane Idalia. Tara Houska, I wanted to bring you into this conversation as an indigenous lawyer and also a peaceful protester against Line 3. You joined us on Democracy Now! After you were released from jail in 2021. You posted photos on social media with bloodied welts on your arms after you were shot with rubber bullets during your peaceful action. Can you talk about the escalation of police violence at the time and how you feel these cases are now going?
Since Standing Rock and the resistance against Dakota Access Pipeline, which you were also at and documented some of the police brutality that occurred there, the escalation of police, both in the direct confrontations with nonviolent protesters and also just the prosecutorial system against specifically environmental activists, has grown exponentially worse. I know that there's been coverage on your program and others about the Atlanta Cop City protests. You just had on someone talking about how they had added on a felony terrorism enhancement. That was up front with the protesters down at Cop City. 42 people charged with domestic terrorism. I feel like the body of ALEC is around the entire state all the state legislatures trying to push felony protest bills that happened in Minnesota, too. They didn't pass it successfully here, but they've passed it other places. The crackdown on environmental protest is nationwide, and it is, I think, a system in which you're seeing everyone trying to push and see just what they can get away with.
There are several other Line 3 cases still open. Next month, three Anishinaabe women, elders Winona LaDuc, Tanya Obed, Dawn Goodwin will go on trial together on gross misdemeanor critical infrastructure charges related to a January 2021 protest. If you can talk about what this all means as the world becomes increasingly conscious of the climate catastrophe, and also the relationship between Enbridge security and Minnesota police and authorities.
We think about the words critical infrastructure. What is actually critical infrastructure to the survival of human beings and every other being on this earth? It's water. Right, that is the actual critical infrastructure. Designating an oil pipeline for fossil fuels bound somewhere else, the active destruction of our own chance at survival, of my daughter's chance of survival, of at her daughter's daughter, it is just an abomination of where we're at as a species. You mentioned all those, you know, increasing signs of climate crisis that is occurring. You know, talking about the global boiling. Right. We're not even saying global warming anymore. It's global boiling, and species extinction is just so painful to watch. And then, you know, you have these attempts by human beings against other human beings who are trying to at least give nature a voice, at least try to do something different, actively pushing against and trying to suppress that voice. Where you see in here in Minnesota, instead of the company behind closed doors, paying off law enforcement to defend their pipeline and defend their project. It was an open agreement overseen by the state of Minnesota, overseen by the Democratic government, overseen by Tim Walz and Peggy Flanagan here in Minnesota. You know, that still stands. They pay them over $8 million, closing in on $9 million. The biggest person that accepted the money, like, or the agency that accepted that money was the Department of Natural Resources. That's the people who are tasked to actually defend the wetlands, which just got deregulated, right? Like, all the nation's wetlands just got deregulated because the EPA no longer has oversight. That's what's happening, and that's the global picture that's happening, not just here, but around the world, where land defenders are not just criminalized, they're killed for defending the earth.
I want to end with Milen, who is speaking to us right before testifying in court. Are you afraid of the sentence you face if you were found guilty, 5 years in prison? Or are you hopeful that perhaps you will go the route of the Montana youth, where a judge has ruled on their behalf around climate protests and climate activism and challenging the state for engaging in destruction of the planet?
I wouldn't say that I'm afraid. I entered this fully aware of the risk I was taking and not really believing that the justice system in this court would be served, would be hearing me fully. So I am aware of what I'm risking, and I'm going there fully aware of the risk. But I'm not scared. I know where I stand. I know what my purpose is here. I'm grateful for you for hearing us today.
What does your T-shirt say?
My T-shirt says "Defend the Sacred." This is the T-shirt I was wearing on that day. This is why I was there. The sacred is the earth, the nature, the water. The people who live on this land, and all the animals and earth, sky, you know, just
well,
the Anishinaabe people have been talking about and doing forever.
Milen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Mylène Villard, water protector on trial in Minnesota for taking part in action against the Enbridge Line 3 tar sands oil pipeline. She will testify today in court. She faces 5 years in prison if convicted. Tara Hauska, Indigenous lawyer, activist, and founder of the Gnu Collective. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue to look at the climate emergency. The Guardian's reporting Hurricane Idalia might become the costliest climate disaster to hit the United States this year. The Category 3 left a trail of destruction from Florida to the Carolinas. Forecasting company AccuWeather is projecting the storm might cost $20 billion. Last week, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, revealed the United States had already suffered at least 15 weather disasters that caused $1 billion or more in damage. While the costs of the climate crisis continue to escalate, climate justice groups are warning the government must do far more to combat the climate emergency. We're joined now by Rihanna Gunright. She was one of the architects of the Green New Deal. She's just written a new piece for Hammer and Hope headlined, "Our Green Transition May Leave Black People Behind." She writes, "I'm an architect of the Green New Deal. I'm worried the racism in the biggest climate law endangers our ability to get off fossil fuels." Rihanna Gunright, take it from there. Explain why you're so deeply concerned.
So I am really deeply concerned because the Inflation Reduction Act, the biggest climate law basically in U.S. history, is setting up the framework for the clean energy transition to come. And so far, there are many provisions in the bill that just structurally leave out Black people or just don't address the needs, particularly of Black frontline communities. And at the same time, the debates and the decisions about how to implement the IRA in those cases, too, we are seeing a trend of the desires of Black frontline communities, again, in particular, being set aside, in some cases being dismissed. And it's very troubling because this is what's going to sort of guide the clean energy transition for the foreseeable future. And as we've seen before in U.S. history, there's often a sense that we can get to justice later, but when does later come? And so all of that amalgamation of factors is what has got me worried at the moment.
Rihanna, you write, "The racist compromises and the marginalization of Black people and their demands that facilitated the bill's passage have seeped into the climate movement." Let's talk very specifically about what you mean.
So what I mean is that in order to pass the IRA, Senate Democrats, leadership in particular, had to broker a deal with Senator Manchin. And part of that deal included compromises, particularly around opening up lease sales in the Gulf, as well as compromises that allowed the building of the Mountain Valley Pipeline to move forward. And it's worth noting that both of those things have been blocked by court challenges from environmental groups and climate justice activists. So both of those things were moved forward despite those challenges by the compromises in order to let the IRA pass. And so when I say that it seeped in, it's what I mean is that in doing that, right, you created some momentum where there was a sense that some amount of racism was a necessary cost for the IRA to move forward, because both with the Gulf sales, the lease sales in the Gulf, and with the Mountain Valley Pipeline, those things disproportionately impact Black frontline communities. And so when I say that it seeped in, I have noticed in debates there's been a real sidelining. I think you see it in particular in the conversation about permitting reform. There's been a real sidelining of Black, brown, and indigenous voices and their calls for a just transition in the debates about how to effectively implement the IRA. And I mean, when I talk about permitting reform, I mean, there is a big push in particular to weaken NEPA, despite the fact that NEPA, the National Environmental Permitting Act, is one of the main tools that frontline communities have to protect themselves and push back against polluting infrastructure. And the real troubling part about that being forefronted in the permitting reform debate is that the IRA also takes a real all of the above strategy when it comes to the energy transition. So that means that it's basically investing in tons of technologies across the board. A lot of that's in renewable energy. A lot of that's in technologies that a lot of people argue can help prop up fossil fuels, even as they could help decarbonize at the same time. And so what that means is that you're going to, along with the concessions, still see a build out of fossil fuel infrastructure as well as renewable energy infrastructure. And so gutting NEPA actually puts frontline communities in a really vulnerable position, even if it is to speed up renewable energy transitions, where at the same time you have a lot of climate justice activists also calling for permitting reform, but in a way that protects democratic participation, that is about, right, increasing the amount of planning, that is about making community consultations upfront more powerful, less antagonistic, trying to sort of build a procedure for infrastructure decisions that helps build trust. But those recommendations are largely being sort of pushed aside, talked about as insufficient, because I think, like I said, in part because of the concessions that happened with the IRA to pass it, there is an increasing sort of narrative about the tension between justice and urgency that's presenting a false choice that says essentially we have to do whatever we have to increase the deployment of renewable energy by any means necessary, even if that means reducing democratic participation, because there's just, like I said, a narrative that says we don't have enough time to make sure that the transition is just, if there is any chance that doesn't come in the form of just like regulatory streamlining across the board.
Brianna, you call for the expansion of Justice 40, a Biden administration initiative that aims to direct 40% of the benefits of federal clean energy and other climate investments to disadvantaged communities. How can this be expanded? And how can the Biden administration nationally subsidize divestment from fossil fuels? We'll end with those two questions.
Can you repeat that last question?
How can the Biden administration nationally subsidize divestment from fossil fuels equitably?
Oh, okay. Totally. So on the first part, so Justice 40 is the administration's pretty much their signature environmental justice initiative, which says that 40% of the benefits of climate and energy investments need to go to disadvantaged communities. I call for the expansion of Justice 40 because Justice 40 was actually initiated before the IRA. And so it is unclear right now whether Justice 40 will apply to IRA spending across the board. What we have seen with Justice 40 is there is a tendency to mostly include programs that are sort of legacy environmental justice programs like weatherization, energy efficiency, or just programs that are sort of siloed in the environmental justice camp and not necessarily spending related to the energy transition more broadly. So I'm calling for Justice 40 to cover all of that, right?
Because that's how we make sure that
the transition does, in fact, benefit everyone if all of the spending is included. At the same time, I do note that, like, funding for projects and technologies that frontline communities have repeatedly opposed, say like carbon capture and storage, that shouldn't be included in Justice 40. At the end of the day, it's just disrespectful if that is not actually the vision that frontline communities are have for their role in the green transition. They want to get polluting infrastructure out entirely. So we should be investing in renewable energy projects that they're asking for, whether that's community solar, microgrids, publicly owned and provided renewable energy. Microgrids. Those are the sort of things that over and over frontline communities and the groups that have that represent them say that they want to get out of a green transition.
Rihanna, we're going to have to leave
it. As far as the Biden administration, how to
We have less than 30 seconds, Rihanna, just less than 30 seconds on that last point of the Biden administration.
Yep. For fossil fuel divest, well, one is there have to be no new leases for fossil fuel projects. The second is that we really need to form, at the very least, a commission to discuss how do we have a responsible wind down of fossil fuels. Right now, we're leaving the divestment and wind down of the fossil fuel industry up to the industry entirely. And what we're seeing over and over is they're not investing in that. And it's very increasingly unlikely that they, in fact, will be investing in low carbon energy in a real way. And so without really a publicly planned transition, we're going to end up with a transition off of fossil fuels that's not just inequitable for Black people, but that harms workers, residents, everyone, consumers, and especially folks from regions where fossil fuels are a big part of that local economy.
Rihanna Gunright, I want to thank you so much for being with us, one of the architects of the Green New Deal. We'll link to your piece in Hammer and Hope, Our Green Transition May Leave Black People Behind. Coming up, we look at why thousands of Afghan evacuees are being arbitrarily detained overseas, waiting to come into the United States. Back in 20 seconds. By 2 yards from the Labor Day classic, Sorry to Bother You. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of Afghan evacuees seeking to come to the United States remain arbitrarily detained in other countries 2 years after the Taliban took control of Afghanistan. Many of the Afghans are living in camps in the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kosovo, that are largely coordinated, facilitated, or under the control of the U.S. government. The Center for Constitutional Rights and the group Muslim Advocates recently sued the Pentagon, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security, seeking governmental records about the relocation and detention of Afghan evacuees. We're joined now by Sarah Dust. She is an attorney and Bertha Justice Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Can you lay out, Sadaf, the extent of the problem, how many people are being held, and what they need to come into the United States?
Thank you so much for raising awareness and covering this issue. Just as you had mentioned, thousands of Afghan civilians are being arbitrarily detained at these sites, and this comes after 20 decades of occupation and invasion and war at the hands of the U.S. government. So we're still seeing that 2 years after the U.S. declared the end of its war in Afghanistan, Afghan civilians still continue to be suffering human rights and humanitarian violations at the hands of the U.S. government. The numbers, because of the very limited reporting that is out there, is uncertain, but what limited reporting is out there indicates that it's over 3,000 people, up to 5,000 or more. And these sites, just as you have mentioned, the ones that are more reported about are in the UAE, Qatar, and Kosovo, but other sites in Albania, Germany, possibly others exist as well. And what this lawsuit hopes to achieve is to provide more information to humanitarian, human rights, and civil society organizations who really are hoping to hold the government accountable and meaningfully engage to intervene and prevent the continued detention of these Afghan civilians.
And Sadaf, tell us who these people are and what they're—I mean, the site in Kosovo, for example, has been nicknamed Little Guantanamo. What happens if they leave the camps? And what was their relationship with the United States as the U.S. occupied Afghanistan? Why did they flee Afghanistan?
Yeah, and— In Kosovo, it is nicknamed Little Guantanamo because of the horrifying conditions. Last year, there was a protest staged by those Afghans detained at these sites, asking for better conditions, asking any government that has a hand in facilitating or coordinating these sites for better conditions. These individuals include human rights activists who had to flee Afghanistan because the Taliban is now and searching for those individuals. This includes journalists, some who worked with news organizations based out here in the U.S. or elsewhere. It includes women rights activists and just lawyers, prosecutors, judges, as well as your everyday Afghan civilians who had to flee because of the compounding humanitarian and human rights crisis in Afghanistan.
I wanted to turn to a clip that we have to play of a person who is waiting. This is a clip that we got that you can introduce it, of a young person who is waiting to come into the country, Sadaf. Let's turn to the clip.
Half the passengers fell into the water and were swallowed up by the sea. Those who were left in the boat tried to stay alive with the help of their tubes. About 2 hours later, the French police arrived and threw tubes at us to save us. Those boys who were in the boat also took along 6 bodies of those who had died in the boat. The rest of the Afghans were lost. Half of the survivors were taken up by the UK police. I never believed I would survive. I thought I was dying and was ready to die. I asked God to forgive my sins. I also remembered my mother and father. I kept swimming for the sake of my parents and my brothers and sisters, because we have left home and are going through all of this suffering for their sake. I was fast losing the strength to swim, but I kept trying very hard to keep afloat.
That was a clip of a young man who was saved, 22-year-old Idris. Last month, a boat full of mostly Afghan refugees capsized in the English Channel as it tried to reach Britain from France. 6 of the people died. Talk about the lengths people are going to.
The lengths are extreme, and what we're hearing from Afghan civilians is that they don't want to leave their home. No person wants to leave their family and their loved ones and where they built a life, a place that they're familiar with, but they have no other option because of the United States' hasty withdrawal and the ground that it laid for what we're seeing now today. There are other reports of Afghans here in the U.S. southern border that are facing very similar conditions where they're not being welcomed. They are traveling multiple continents, 12 to 14 countries, just to come here in the U.S. and be locked up in discriminatory policies that are really targeting Muslims and Afghans.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Sadaf Dous, for joining us. Afghan-American attorney, Bertha Justice Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we can will continue to follow this case. To see our podcast, video and audio podcast, and sign up for our news website, you can go to democracynow.org, our newsletter. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
The Vancouver Art Gallery presents the Vancouver-based artist Mary Corey's most recent work, I Love, in the gallery's first floor rotunda until November 19, 2023. Paying homage to the calligraphic nature of Arabic in her work, Corey draws inspiration from Henry Moore's sensuous sculptures and Zaha Hadid's organic architectural structures. To learn more about this exhibition, visit vanartgallery.bc.ca.